You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The late 60s saw a birth of many activist groups fighting to change the status quo, particularly in light of the ongoing Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement. Such a group was Science for the People. It was a radical science organization made up of scientists who challenged the relationship between their work and government power. And there was a lot of interest among its members to reorganize American society from a capitalist to a socialist base. By 1990, Science for the People had dissolved. But it is back, a revived movement of radical scientists. The group's having its convention this Friday evening at the University of Michigan campus. Fern McDougall is a master's student at the U of M School for Environment and Sustainability and a member of U of M's chapter of Science for the People. Fern, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
What's the mission? What are the principles that drive this revived Science for the People?
We oppose exploitation, marginalization, and oppression in science and society. We oppose the use of science for profiteering, capitalism, imperialism, war, etc.
What is the political and economic critique of the status quo that the group has?
So we look at science and we ask ourselves the questions, who is science actually serving? Who's controlling what research is done? Who is performing the science? And we look at who has the privilege to actually be doing that. Who is funding this science, and what do they want out of it? What are the products of this science, and how will they be used? And realistically, who has the means to use them and to what ends? And we think a lot about the ethics of the science itself as it's practiced.
What's the current state of the organization as it's kind of getting revived after a decade and a half?
Well, it's very exciting because there's been some interest since 2014, especially in reviving the group. But I would say that the current organizers who have organized this convention have been working together for a little over a year. Things have grown very quickly. Right now, we have a website. We're working on reviving the publication, and we've written bylaws and organizational structure that we'd like to ratify at this convention. And we've started forming some working groups, and that's another purpose of the convention, to get together, propose some ideas that relate to our scientific work or to activism, and to connect with each other so that we can form groups to work on those particular issues at the intersection of science and anti-capitalism and social justice.
And indeed, you were expecting a smaller number and wound up surprised at how many people signed up for the event on Friday?
Absolutely. I was handling registration, so I wasn't sure what to do. We're a smaller group of core organizers, and we thought it was going to be a smaller group of people, 25 to 50, and we planned accordingly. We didn't promote the event extremely widely, but we did in our networks. And people really came out of the woodwork to come to this, people whose names I had ever heard of doing work at different universities or from different parts of the country. A couple of people are coming from Mexico. One person's coming from Canada. One person's coming from China.
So this is quite the convention. And you, as you say, you're pulling in international interest. The history of Science for the People, digging into it, you realize it includes supporting, and dare we say, romanticizing repressive regimes. I'm thinking of a page from the Science for the People magazine I looked at from May 1972. It was the report from the China Collective, and they were planning an SFP visit to the People's Republic of China. So we had Chairman Mao in power. It was in the middle of the violent Cultural Revolution. The report in the magazine talks about being China, and I'm using the language here, as a revolutionary socialist society, as one place where concrete solutions are being tested, a chance to see what revolutionary change actually means to a people. How do you feel about that embrace, the history of that embrace of such a repressive regime?
So that's something that our organization has to wrestle with. And I don't think that characterizes the organization now. Like, I think that we have high hopes and wanted to shed our cultural bias and understand, all right, what is the potential for socialism? Is there the potential here for egalitarian social and economic forms? And we know that a lot of those have failed and been co-opted by power, right, and have become incredibly repressive. And I know that I have anti-authoritarian values, and a lot of people in the current Science for the People do as well.
Do a lot of the people in the group support and embrace socialism or communism?
I think when a lot of people say socialism, they're talking about state socialism. So people envision, all right, the government has more power and it's taking resources and distributing them. Science for the People is definitely socialist in the sense that we believe in economic equality and prohibiting the accumulation of wealth by some on the backs of other people. But that doesn't mean we support state socialism. Now, as an organization, we're not sectarian, and we don't all have perfectly unified beliefs on any of this. We have democratic values and anti-authoritarian values and values for social equality and absolutely values for socialism. And I'm sure there are a lot of communists in our group, and there are people of other political identities in the group. But those are our shared common values.
Fern, what do you see as the risks that come with mixing science with politics?
My organization would say, we're not mixing science with politics. We're shedding light on the fact that science is political. One reason I think that this convention and Science for the People is resonating in this political moment is that there has been a lot of dialogue nationally about what is the relationship between science and politics.
We certainly saw the Scientist March last April.
Yes. And so a lot of people, not all, but a lot of the organizers, and one of the main messages for the march was, we want to march against the politicization of science. We want to make sure that science is protected as apolitical. And I would identify with the concerns about the results of science being thrown out when they're inconvenient to power. But I think that we need a more complex critique than one that paints scientists as sort of the disinterested, heroic saviors all the time. And we need to look at the way is that science is political. So like I said before, who is funding the science, how it is being used, who actually has power over the products of that science, those things all make science a very political activity. And if we deny that, then those things are invisible. But if we express that all of those decisions about what we do with science are political, then that gives the kind of transparency for us to say, well, what are we going to do with science? If this is a political choice, how do we want science to be used?
When I think of Science for the People as radical scientists gathering together, should a scientist's political views be a factor in whether they should get funding for their research? Should it factor into whether we, the public, can trust the results of their work?
I think you're trying to get at objectivity in the results of science, which is an important concern. Science for the People is also concerned with that. We don't want bias to affect how we're perceiving our results, the results to experiments that we're getting when we're trying to just understand the truth. So one of the ways that Science for the People is valuable to understanding objectivity in science is we say that, well, science is not objective. We are bringing with us a lot of cultural values that shape the work that we're doing. Whenever you say, well, should this be a factor, I want to ask, who's deciding that? Do you mean that the government should or shouldn't fund people based on their political interests? And that's, of course, a freedom of speech and freedom of association issue. And one of the attendees, Chandler Davis, was actually fired from the University of Michigan and was imprisoned in the 50s for refusing to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. There's an issue of political freedom there. There's an issue of bias there. And I think that if we understand our bias and are open and transparent about that, we have a better chance of addressing it.
Why is reviving this movement necessary for society today in 2018, in your view?
Well, I think that we're in a really critical political moment where people are asking themselves fundamental questions about the social, political, and economic systems we're living under. One solution is, well, we just need left-leaning moderate who is going to maybe provide some social services to people, but ultimately we want our leaders to uphold the economic and social systems that exist, and those can be tweaked to serve people. And the other path says, well, no, right now we're seeing the extent to which these systems can be used against people and the planet as they exist. But there was something very fundamentally wrong with global capitalism that produced climate change, produces hunger, frankly, produces poverty on a massive scale, produces migration from country to country. So the other choice is to challenge the underlying political and economic systems.
And challenging it is exactly what Science for the People is about. Fern McDougall with the Ann Arbor chapter of Science for the People, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.